Okay, so you know how sometimes a case just jumps out at you and you think, whoa, there's something big going on
Yeah,
here.
I get that. Happens to me all the time, especially with ex post facto issues.
Well, this Shenfell v. State case is like that for me. I really want to just break it down, like get to the core of how the ex post facto clause works when you're dealing with changes in probation procedures. It's about drawing those boundaries for legislative power, right?
Absolutely. And it's a core protection for everyone. I mean, the government can't just suddenly change the legal consequences for something you did in the past if the rules were different back then. It's a fairness issue, you know? Like, imagine playing a game and then someone tries to change the scoring after you've already made your moves.
Right. Totally unfair. Okay, so let's get into the weeds a bit. First things first, when we say ex post facto clause, where do we even find this thing?
Two key places for now. You got Article 1, Section 9 of the US Constitution, and then it's also mirrored in the Florida Constitution. Basically, both of them say no ex post facto laws. Pretty straightforward.
Okay, so no ex post facto laws. But what exactly does that mean? Like, what does an ex post facto violation actually look like?
For that, we got to go way back to a landmark Supreme Court case, Calder v. Bull. This was back in 1798.
Oh, yeah. Calder v. Bull. That's a classic. What were the big takeaways from that case?
Well, Calder lays out four main types of laws that would be considered ex post facto violations. Number one, any law that makes something a crime that wasn't a crime when it happened, you know, can't go back in time and say, oh, what you did yesterday is now illegal.
Right. That makes sense. What else?
Second, a law that makes a crime more serious than it was when it was committed, adding on punishments after the fact. You know, like if they suddenly decide that a misdemeanor is now a felony for something that happened 5 years ago.
Gotcha. So it's not just about making something criminal, it's also about making the consequences worse after the fact.
Precisely. And then number three, laws that straight up increase the punishment for a crime after it's already been done. You know, like changing a sentence from 5 years to 10 years for someone who's already serving time.
Okay, that's a direct hit on the punishment itself. This is the fourth category.
The fourth one's about the rules of evidence. You can't have a law that changes the rules of evidence to make it easier to convict someone for a past crime. That wouldn't be fair either.
I see. So it's like rigging the game in favor of the prosecution after the fact.
Exactly. And these four categories from Calder, those are your go-to for analyzing any ex post facto claim.
Okay, so we have our four categories. Now let's apply this to the Shenfeld case.
Yeah.
What was the situation with Mr. Shenfeld?
So back in 2002, Jason Shenfeld pleaded guilty to robbery in Florida. He got a 5-year suspended sentence and was placed on probation.
Okay, 5 years suspended, meaning he wouldn't have to serve the time unless he violated probation.
Exactly. Then a couple of years later, in 2004, his probation was changed to administrative probation. That's a less restrictive form of probation.
Okay, so less supervision. What happened next?
Fast forward to 2007, Shenfeld gets arrested again. This time it was for some really serious offenses, murder and sexual battery. And the allegations were that he committed these crimes while he was still on probation.
Whoa. Okay, so new charges while on probation for the initial robbery conviction definitely complicates things. Where does the ex post facto issue come into play here?
Here's the thing. After his 2007 arrest, an amended probation violation affidavit was filed against Shenfeld. Now, here's the catch. This amended affidavit was filed after the original 5-year probation period for the robbery would have ended.
Hold on, I'm trying to follow the timeline here. So he was arrested in 2007 for new crimes, but the probation violation paperwork was filed after his initial 5-year probation period would have expired.
You got it. And the reason they could file that amended affidavit after the 5 years was because of a change in Florida law back in 2005.
Okay, a law change. How did that affect Shenfeld's situation?
Well, that 2005 amendment allowed for what's called tolling of probation. Basically, pausing the clock on the probation period, even without an arrest warrant. It meant that under certain circumstances, even if someone wasn't immediately arrested, their probation wouldn't automatically expire after the set time.
So they could essentially extend the probation period based on this new law.
Yeah, in certain situations.
Yeah.
And that's the heart of Shenfeld's argument. He said, hey, my probation started back in 2002 under the old rules. You can't apply this 2005 law to extend my probation retroactively. That's an ex post facto violation.
So he was saying they were changing the rules of the game after he'd already started playing.
Exactly. So the big question for the court was whether applying that 2005 amendment to Schoenfeld's probation violated his rights under the ex post facto clause. It was a close call, you know, really nuanced.
So, how did the court ultimately rule?
The court really focused on the difference between what are called procedural laws and substantive laws.
Okay, so what's the difference?
Basically, substantive law defines the crimes themselves and the punishments. Procedural law is about how the legal process works, you know, the steps and rules for enforcing the law. The court decided that the 2005 amendment about tolling probation was a procedural change.
So a change in how the system works, not a change in the crime itself or the punishment for it.
Exactly. The amendment didn't change the fact that robbery was a crime or what the potential punishment for robbery was. It just changed the process for how probation violations were handled. It changed the way the clock could be stopped on someone's probation period.
Okay, I'm starting to see their logic. So they didn't view this 2005 law as changing the substance of Schoenfeld's sentence for the original robbery.
Right. They made a point of saying that the amendment didn't retroactively increase his original 5-year suspended sentence for the robbery. That stayed the same.
But wait, didn't he end up with a 15-year sentence?
He did. But that 15-year sentence was for the new crimes he was accused of committing while on probation, the murder and sexual battery. The court was very clear that those were separate actions from the initial robbery.
Okay, I get it. So even though applying the 2005 amendment allowed the state to go after him for the probation violation, which might have indirectly led to the longer sentence for the new crimes, the court didn't see it as changing the punishment for the original robbery itself. How did they use that Calder v. Bull case to explain their thinking?
The court went back to those 4 categories of ex post facto violations that Calder laid out, and they said, look, this 2005 amendment doesn't fit into any of those categories.
Let's go through them one by one to make sure I'm following you.
Sure. First, did the amendment make something a crime that wasn't a crime back in 2002 when Schoenfeld was originally sentenced? Nope. Robbery was already a crime.
Right. Okay. What about the second category?
Second, did it make robbery a more serious crime than it was back then? No. It didn't change the definition or severity of robbery at all.
Okay. That makes sense. What about increasing the punishment?
That's the third category. Did this amendment increase the potential punishment for robbery? Again, no. The maximum sentence for robbery stayed the same. His original 5-year suspended sentence remained untouched.
Okay, so 3 down and 1 to go. What about that last category, changing the rules of evidence?
The court said that the 2005 amendment didn't do that either. It didn't make it easier to convict someone of robbery. It was purely about the process of probation, not about changing the elements of the crime or the evidence needed to prove it.
So they were basically saying it's a change in the mechanics, not the substance of the law.
Yeah, and because it didn't fit into any of the Calder categories, they said there was no ex post facto violation.
This is really helpful to understand how courts think about these issues. So if I'm a law student listening to this, what are the key takeaways about the Schoenfeld case?
Big picture takeaway is that changes in the procedures for how probation is handled, those are usually going to be okay, even if they're applied retroactively, as long as they don't increase the original punishment.
So it's fine to tweak the system as long as you don't mess with the original sentence someone got.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And the Schoenfeld case really highlights the difference between the sentence you get for the original crime and then the consequences for anything new you do while you're on probation.
Right, like in Schoenfeld's case, the new very serious charges.
Exactly. And often when someone is sentenced for violating their probation, it's treated differently than the original sentencing.
How so?
Well, with a probation violation, the courts can use the sentencing guidelines that are in effect at the time of the violation. They don't have to stick with the guidelines that were in place way back when the original crime happened.
So probation violations are kind of like their own separate thing.
In a way, yes. The court in Schoenfeld actually pointed out that there's established case law in Florida that supports this idea.
What's that idea exactly?
Yeah. The idea is that probation violations are considered new conduct, and that the laws in effect at the time of that new conduct are the ones that apply, not necessarily the laws from when the original crime was committed.
So it's not really about going back in time and changing the rules. It's more about applying the current rules to current behavior, even if that behavior is connected to a past crime.
You got it. And Schoenfeld gives us a really clear example of how courts analyze these ex post facto arguments when procedural rules change, particularly with probation.
Okay, so wrapping it up for our listeners, this deep dive into Schoenfeld v. State was all about how courts look at the ex post facto clause when procedures change, especially for probation. And the key is that the Constitution is mainly concerned with preventing changes that make crimes worse or punishments harsher after someone has already committed a crime. It's less worried about tweaking the details of how the justice system operates as long as those tweaks don't increase someone's punishment for a past offense.
Well said. It's that distinction between changing the core rules of the game versus adjusting how the game is played without unfairly punishing someone for what they did before the adjustments were made.
It's fascinating to me how these big constitutional principles play out in real-life legal cases. But before we wrap up, here's something for our listeners to think about, especially for those of you who are law students. How might this distinction between procedural and substantive law, which we saw at work in Shenfeld, affect other areas of criminal law? As laws and procedures continue to change, what kinds of changes might be challenged under the ex post facto clause? And based on what we learned from Calder and Shenfeld, what specific elements of those changes would be most likely to cause constitutional problems? It's a super important area to think about as you continue your legal studies and as you grapple with the always evolving world of criminal justice. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.